I woke up and one morning and was just really, really sick, and I couldn't walk. My foot was super swollen, and I had met this Danish girl the night before, and I remembered that she was a nurse. So I kind of like jumped down to the common area on one foot, and I said, you're a nurse, right? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what do you think about this? And she, her mouth came open. She goes, oh my God, you need to get to a hospital. Like now.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Right. And, I was like, well, you know, I was kind of thinking that this ride was going to last another like 3 or 4 days. And is there any way you think that I can just finish it up? She said, absolutely not. You have to go and get medical attention as quickly as you can.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast.
Four years ago, I bought a new truck for the first time ever, and I was so excited. It was incredible. It smelled good. It felt good. I wasn't constantly afraid of breaking down, you know? It was awesome. But after I drove it for a couple weeks, I do the same thing that I always do, and the backseat started to fill up with stuff. You know, I'm guiding elk hunters and deer hunters, and I'm duck hunting, and I'm fly fishing, and all that gear just accumulates. And pretty soon, I wasn't able to take people with me anymore, and I was embarrassed. You know, people would ask for a ride, and like, nah, sorry, man, I've got too much stuff with me. But I couldn't put it in the bed because then it gets damaged by weather, so I go to the internet, and I'm looking for options, and I ended up buying a deck-to-drawer system. Now, this was a big purchase for me, but it's something that I felt like I needed, and it looked like it was going to be a good product, and it really was. Dect came out with a new drawer system this year, and they've made some meaningful improvements over the previous one. You have almost no wasted space in your truck bed now, so you can access the sides of the drawers, and then the drawers roll a full 18 inches farther out, so you can actually access the back of the drawer, even if you don't have a lot of arm reach. There's some really strong tie-down points on top that have a 400-pound load rating, so if you're going to haul something like a motorcycle or big coolers or whatever, you can really strap your gear down and make it secure. You can lock these drawer systems, so you can lock the drawers, or if your tailgate locks, then nobody can access the drawers anyways. So I actually feel like my stuff is more secure inside this drawer system than in the cab of my truck. That's a big deal to me. The complete deck system is made in America by Americans, and you know that that's something that I love and appreciate. They've got one that will fit in any truck or van that's been made in America in the last 20 years plus. You can go to decked.com/sixranch and get free shipping. But just being honest with you, they get free shipping to everybody. I also, while you're there, want you to check out their deco line. So they've got a bunch of different boxes and storage containers that either fit on top of or inside of the drawer system. And those are built really robust. I saw the prototypes at an event this summer. I'm impressed. I'm excited to get my hands on them. I haven't yet. But the prototypes were super badass. And the ones that are in production model, they're available now over at decked.com. So even if you just need a place for some tools, or you need a new bow case, or you know, something along those lines, go check that out. And if you're driving around right now and your backseat is just full of gear and you can't haul people around, maybe you should consider looking at the full deck drawer system, because it's a good piece of gear. It was a good purchase for me, and I hope it helps you. Are you embarrassed to have been a smoke jumper instead of a rappeller?
Oh, wow. Right out the gate. I have a lot of feelings about being a jumper. I don't, embarrassment is one of the things that I'd ever really considered. I don't think so.
You were a BLM jumper, weren't you?
I did both, actually.
You did both.
I jumped for the Forest Service for 4 years, and I jumped for the BLM for 4 years.
Did you like that job?
I did.
Yeah. I mean, 8 years is a long time. Most people don't make it that long.
Yeah. Most people are smart enough to get out sooner than that.
Yeah. Well, you're a physical specimen too. Like you're a super freak athlete. And I think that what you endure in wildland firefighting, especially aerial delivered wildland firefighting, it's hard on the body, man. People just tend to break down. Like it's hips, it's knees. Every rappeller I know has like really serious neck issues from the heavy packouts.
Mm-hmm.
You're just asking more of your body than what most people's bodies are capable of putting out. And I think that that's something that every jumper I've ever met who did it for a long time has in common, is a really similar build. Like it takes a specific type of person just to be able to physically do it.
Yeah. For sure. The work itself is challenging. But really it's the packouts that are kind of like your ability to do that kind of determines whether or not you can do the job. 125 pounds is not uncommon, and you definitely have to kind of be built for it, no matter how tough you are.
Right.
If you're carrying around, you know, depending on the size of your own body. I've worked with some people that, you know, they're packing packs that are just, you know, 20 pounds lighter than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely takes a toll.
My buddy, Cole Kramer, who's a bear multi-species guide in Alaska, mostly bear. He has to do a lot of heavy packing, and he's got a real similar build to you. Cole pointed something interesting out to me, which is that, you know, you can have a 150-pound person who can pack pretty close to their own body weight, but you'll almost never have a 300-pound person that can pack close to their body weight, even if, and I'm talking about putting it in a backpack and carrying it up a mountain,
mm-hmm.
but I don't care if you go to like the World Strongman competition where, you know, you've got 300-pound guys that are super, super strong, they're probably not going to be able to put on a 300-pound pack and go up the mountain for 7 or 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a 150-pound person might be able to carry their own body weight up that hill.
Right.
So there's some interesting, like, physical limitations on packing that aren't scalable with humans.
Right.
You know, isn't that weird?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, it's still the structure of the body is carrying the weight. And if you're already 300 pounds, I mean, you've got a lot more muscle and everything, but you're already packing 300 pounds.
Right.
So then you think about doubling that, and you know, the human skeleton is not really built to be carrying around 600 pounds for
exactly
really any given amount of time, especially prolonged.
Yeah. No, you can like deadlift it for a second while the veins pop out of your face and throw it back down and be like, woohoo.
Yeah, right.
I'm strong.
Yeah. It's kind of a unique blend of just the raw strength and then the endurance component of it as well.
Yeah. You ever have any close calls fighting fire?
I did. None of them, as far as like the actual fires concerned, while I was a jumper. But when I was on the hotshot crew, we had a situation in eastern Montana where like a thunder cell had come through, and we were trying to burn out a piece of line that was pretty critical in hooking this bit of the fire. And we knew that weather was coming in, but
was it at night?
It was in the daytime, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. But we knew that we had a lot of line to burn, and it was pretty light, flashy, kind of rolling grasslands.
Sure.
And
which can go fast.
Very fast. It go about as fast as the wind will blow.
Yeah.
And so we were trying like mad to get this piece in, and the boss was pushing us hard, and, you know, basically had given me the torch and was telling me to more or less run with it. And we had a significant 180 degree wind shift, and winds went from 10 in one direction to about 45 in the other. And we quickly found ourselves like very well running for our lives. And
we're in 8-pound boots.
Right. Yeah. And the fire obviously moving way faster than we could.
Mm-hmm.
We had a squad boss that was able to somehow keep some really good awareness, because it was instantly, this is the blackest conditions that I've ever been in. It was kind of a mix of ash and smoke and everything and dirt that would have been blown. It was kind of a microburst. But the guy that was almost within arm's reach of me, I couldn't see him at all.
Yeah.
And we basically just ran, and then there was a fence that everyone was hung up in, and
oof.
But we all got through that, and the lookout was saying, you know, run east or west or whatever direction, I can't remember exactly, and I absolutely had no idea where that was.
Yeah.
But one of our squaddies, he...
How could you know?
I don't know. I mean, it'd be like being in a black room.
Yeah.
And say go one direction, and it's like, well, no idea where that is.
Right.
But I know which way the heat is coming from, and so we're going away from that. But and we probably would have just kept running in that direction until we were overtaken. But this squad boss, he had us take a 90-degree turn and run in a parallel or perpendicular, I guess, the route we were traveling, and popped out just about the time it blew through, and it made about a quarter mile, half mile run in a matter of a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm no doubt he saved all of our lives that day for sure.
Yeah. I'm not sure what your guys's fitness standards were, and I can't fully remember what ours were. Every wildland firefighter has to do a 3-mile pack test with 45 pounds in 45 minutes, mm-hmm. right? So that's like your basic, if you're going to be on the fire line, you have to be at least physically capable enough to do that. And that doesn't sound like much saying it, you know, 3 15-minute miles carrying 45 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about blowing your shins out, man.
Oh, buddy.
Yeah. Because it's just a little bit faster than you want to walk.
Mm-hmm.
And, I always, like, started the season with shin splints from that stupid thing.
100%.
But I think we had an 85-pound, 2-mile pack test, which I never carried a pack as light as 85 pounds ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my line pack was, you know, 25 or 30 pounds. But as far as packing out of the fire, you're going to be north of 100 every single time, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a really important test, and there'd be some rolling hills and stuff in there, and I can't remember what the time standard was, but basically you had to be physically able to walk at a, you know, 3-mile-an-hour pace or close to it with 85 pounds on. And then there was it a 2-mile run? I can't remember exactly what the, if it was 2-mile or 3-mile.
Mile and a half is the standard.
Yeah. And you had to do that at a pretty good clip.
Yeah. If I remember, I think it's 9.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty good clip. And especially for, you know, some of the guys that, you know, are built big.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite a... So there are two different standards. The standards for the Forest Service and the standards for the BLM are different.
Mm.
The standards for the BLM are more challenging.
Yeah.
I might be stepping on it here, but I was always more impressed with the BLM jumpers that I was around than the Forest Service jumpers. What's your sense? I mean, you did both.
Yeah.
Like if you could start over and just do 8 years with one jump crew, who would it be?
Boy, I know the answer. I might not make, you know, any friends with the other guys that I used to jump with in the Forest Service. But honestly, if I had to do it again and I had to choose one agency, I would go with the BLM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can say that and still love the guys that you fought fire with at the Forest Service. Like, that doesn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, those aren't exclusive deals. How did you like jumping compared to hotshotting?
Well, I liked hotshotting quite a bit. You know, and I was younger, and I think it's a great way to start off, because you really... I mean, you... There's no doubt about it. You work much harder as a hotshot. And you do it in a very regimented way with, you know, a crew of 20 people. And there's just a ton more structure in it. There's a hierarchy. And, you know, it's a great base from which to start. But jumping, you kind of feel like, rather than working for someone, you almost feel like you're just... almost like an independent contractor out there kind of doing your own thing. And there's a lot more kind of latitude to sort of act independently, make decisions. And I really like the aspect of that, is that, you know, one day you might jump a fire with just a two-manner. With a buddy. Yeah. And, you know, you just a single lightning struck snag out there smoking in the middle of the wilderness, and you jump the fire and you get the thing lined in, you know, an hour or two, and you got mop up for a few hours and kind of sit on it and make sure that it's not going to go anywhere. And it turns into like a para camping trip.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a real relaxed kind of situation. And, you know, the next might be a ripping, you know, desert fire that's, you know, it might be 5,000 acres and running. And the only reason you're even jumping it with eight people is to more or less provide like an overhead structure, aerial borne, you know, overhead team, more or less. And in the BLM, we always made sure that there was a Type 3 IC on every load.
Yeah.
And you hit the ground and you might not even pull Pulaski out. It's just basically you start sending scouts out to see what you've got going on. You have, you know, your IC starting to plan. You've got somebody who will step up to logistics. Somebody will kind of start breaking things down into divisions and more or less ordering up all the resources that you're going to need.
Yeah.
And
running the air show.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting how the seasons go too, because you start out with no fire in the springtime, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you go up to Alaska and fight fire up there a little bit. They have a really early season. And then you go down to the Southwest and you catch a couple fires, and then you lose the fires. You know, they get kind of too big too fast. Then the monsoons push in and everybody comes back up to the, you know, Pacific Northwest and the Northern Rockies. And by this point, it's July, and you're getting those single tree fires, or maybe a fire that burns up an acre or two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're still catching them. You're in great shape. Everybody's healthy and happy. And then comes dirty-ass August.
Yeah, dirty August is for sure a thing.
Yep, dirty August. And sometime in the first week of August, you get that fire that you can almost catch and you don't. And then it just gobbles up hillsides and melts asphalt. And, you know, it's just a terrifying and wonderful thing to behold. And then sometime in the next week is when somebody's going to get burned up in a fire, or a whole crew is going to get burned up in a fire. And like, it gets very real all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody's outlook on firefighting changes. And it seems to happen like this just about every year. You know, it's not every year that we get wildland firefighters killed by fire. Most of them are vehicle accidents, trees falling on them, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it got increasingly hard on me, Bjorn, the longer I did it when other firefighters died. And I was in it long enough to have fires that I'd put out get burned up by other fires.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, what is the point of all this? What am I doing?
Right.
You know, am I just making money? Like, am I just paying for college, or is there a higher calling to the type of risk that I'm subjecting myself to? And ultimately I found that answer was no. And that's about the time that I transitioned into the Marine Corps instead. But you've stayed in fire. So you work in a structure fire department now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you like that?
Well, it's a lot different. And, I enjoy the job. I preferred the job as a wildland firefighter.
Yeah.
I think that I belong in the woods. And, you know, the people that I worked with were of a higher caliber, and the esprit de corps and everything about it was better except for the lifestyle.
Mm.
And after 13 years in wildland, I started to kind of miss, having normal type of lifestyle, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never had a dog. I owned a house that I'd spent like 3 months a year in.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't had a relationship that lasted longer than a year.
Right.
And it's tough to kind of have some of these things when you're on the road for 6 months or 8 months. And then when you get off, you want to, you know, go and travel a bit, and go and try to nurture relationships with family and things like that that you've neglected, and really there's no bit of normalcy to the thing. And the structure firefighting job is just kind of allows you to have like more normal lifestyle. And
yeah,
like the concept of like even getting together and having a barbecue or going out on the lake in your buddy's boat or things. It's like I hadn't experienced anything like that since I was 17 years old. And I kind of felt like I had my first regular summer at the age of about 32 years old.
I feel like this last summer was one of the first ones in my life that I could enjoy the way I'd heard other people talk about enjoying summers.
Right.
You know, it was always an extra hustle time one way or another, whether that was ranching. Like, summer is your time. If you've got stuff to build, if you've got stuff to do, like, summer is your time that you can actually go get that work done. You know, if you're going to school, you're in school, you know, fall, spring, and winter. So summer is your time to make enough money to be able to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, living in an area like this, summer's when all of our tourists show up. So if you're in the guiding industry or hospitality or entertainment, anything like that, summer's like your big hustle. In the Marine Corps, summer was the fighting season, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the Middle East, like, they have a very distinctive fighting season, and kind of their like farming, put stuff back together in the wintertime season. And it's 100%. Because of the income that I make from this show, that I was able to actually dial back a little bit and enjoy summer and take those nice days and go to the lake and go spearfishing, or, you know, just go stop in and say hi to friends and, you know, kind of do that American dream stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice.
It's
really nice. I don't regret the work that I've done prior to this, but I am so grateful to be able to enjoy it a little bit more now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I'm glad to be able to experience like what you just talked about.
One thing that wildland affords you is some really interesting time off in the winter. And you know, some wildland firefighters just like play video games and, you know, hang out on the couch all winter long. But a lot of them are very adventurous people, and they'll go to South America, or they'll go someplace where they can ski all winter long, or snowboard if they're a trashy human.
yeah.
Just kidding. I don't care. But it does afford you some really interesting opportunities. You got to go cowboy in Argentina one winter, right?
Yeah.
Or was it multiple years?
Just did that one year.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was fantastic opportunity. In fact, there was a smoke jumper that jumped out of McCall for a lot of years. And when he retired, he had gone down to the Mendoza area and had a winery and kind of a farm, finca, they call it. And it was kind of understood that anybody, any jumper that wanted to come down and spend the winter working for him, he'd put him up, room and board and everything. And I'd known some people that had done that, and it was something that really interested me. And so I reached out, and it just so happened that he didn't have, he wasn't going to have anybody work that winter. I think they were renovating a bunch of their buildings and things like that. So he just basically said that he wouldn't have a place for me to stay and all that. And it was kind of a no-go, but I'd already had my heart set on it. And so I said, man, I'll sleep in a tent or whatever, you know, that's not going to bother me. And he was pretty adamant, like, no, just not doing it. But I kind of sent him a resume. At that point, I had never even actually met the guy. Mm. And, you know, I'd sent him, you know, kind of a work history and things like that, trying to sell myself as somebody that would be an asset down there. And he had noticed that I'd put down, you know, that I'd worked on horseback. I'd done cowboy and stuff, and, you know, basically just kind of telling him all of the different things, construction background and, you know, more or less anything that would show that I, you know, can work. And he said, I know a guy that's got a ranch about 18 hours north of here. And I don't know if he's looking for any help or anything, but I could give you his contact info. And that just kind of more or less cold called the owner of the place is actually an American guy. Yeah. And, you know, I contacted him and I said, I would love to, you know, help out if there's any reason, you know, you could use me. And he said, yeah, we could definitely do that. And so he got me in touch with more or less the ranch manager down there. And there was a couple of different ways he could see that I could help him. One was that he kind of had this vision of turning the place into like a ecotourism destination.
Okay.
And was interested in kind of getting some exposure out there. And so he had sort of paid me to do a blog, and that was kind of the beginning stages of like blogging and all of that. And so I did that. He also used me to mule a bunch of American currency into the country, which was pretty interesting.
Wow.
To have a conversation with a guy over the phone, and then him wiring something like, you know, the maximum amount of $8,000 or $10,000 or $12,000 or whatever, and me being responsible for this guy's money and trying to get it into the country, because, you know, as you probably know, they're currently having issues, and you know, they have for a long time. The American dollar is really valuable down there and a lot more stable. And so, yeah, he had me bring down a ton of cash, which I wasn't really comfortable with doing, but he paid for my plane ticket and stuff like that. So it was all worth it.
Nice.
But then
Was he doing shady stuff?
You know, it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
I didn't ask a lot of questions about it.
Nothing that you ended up having to get involved in, though.
No.
Yeah.
No, I showed up with the money, and I did, I did stay in Buenos Aires for a day or two prior to flying up to Salta, where they picked me up. And so, you know, I was staying in a hostel with, you know, like probably a year's wage for most of those people. And it was definitely, you know, you got your little metal locker with a padlock on it or something like that, just hoping that it would be really hard to show up and try to explain how you'd lost 10 grand.
Right. Yeah. Buenos Aires, huge city.
Yeah.
Like it's almost hard to understand how big it is. If you fly through Argentina, there's a good chance you'll have to change airports in Buenos Aires at some point, and you'll have to go through town, and it's just impressively big. I'd be really nervous in that scenario. I also recommend if people are traveling down there, like if they're going to Tierra del Fuego or something, don't get a cab because you'll get hustled. Like, you can use Uber now.
And, right.
You know, then there's at least some oversight over it. But yeah, there's a lot of hustle. We had to bribe our way out of Argentina, and it's just kind of how they do business. So what was your role on the ranch while you were down there?
Well, the ranch was 40,000 acres.
Is that a big place for that area?
I think that was probably pretty big. I don't have any experience on any other places, so it's kind of hard to...
That's a big outfit, but for sure. Yeah. I think anywhere.
And it was their season to gather, and so we're basically out there just hunting bovine. And but the first thing, I mean, I'd done a lot of gathering for people, and the differences between the cows there and the cows here are a lot more vast than I would have ever expected. This was like trying to, you know, bring in elk or something. You know, they're not just these fat, happy animals that are, you know, all you got to do is get behind them and whistle and they'll happily like trail to wherever you want them to go. These things are athletic and wild animals.
Yeah.
And if they catch a glimpse of you from a half mile away, they're running as fast as they can through the thickest, nastiest brush imaginable. Every single thing down there, kind of the slope of the Andes, it was kind of what I would imagine West Texas being, like real arid, super rocky, really inhospitable terrain. And every single bush has thorns or hooks or things that we basically had to wear. Like a rawhide pseudo armor to be able to even navigate. And if there's a cow in there, there's times and you kind of lean forward, cover the horse's eyes, kick them, and you just start plowing through this stuff. And the saddles have these big built up like rawhide fenders that kind of protect your legs and the horse itself. And you've got a real stiff jacket and a wide brim hat that was made out of rawhide. It was almost like a hard hat.
Wow.
But if you didn't have that stuff, the clothes on your back would have been stripped off.
Just get shredded.
In 50 feet, you'd be naked and bloody.
Dude, I just heard this story about somebody who drove off the road in Western Oregon into drove off a hill into this big blackberry patch. And the blackberries just kind of swallowed the car up, so people couldn't tell that anything had happened there.
Yeah.
And it took them multiple days to make it, like, just up this hill back onto the road. And when they made it out, they were completely shredded, no clothes left, like came close to being so hung up in those thorns that it would have killed them.
Yeah.
I don't like thorns. I mean, people have varying levels of tolerances for that. If I'm getting hung up, and especially if the thorns are breaking off in me, if they just want to like take chunks out of me or stripe me up, like that's something I can deal with. But if they're breaking off in my skin, that's what gets me wanting to be anywhere else really quickly. It is just miserable.
Yeah.
And it's always in really tough environments, right? If you're in a really nice area that's pleasant and comfortable to be in weather-wise and otherwise, not a lot of thorns. The plants are fairly happy there. Mm-hmm. But the tougher the environment, the angrier those plants get.
Yeah.
And West Texas is definitely one of those spots. Yeah. Well, that's wild. Armored up with rawhide all the way through. How many head did he end up gathering? Do you remember?
Well, probably just a few hundred. Yeah. And the thing is that because they're completely unwilling to trail, you literally had to drag every single individual with a rope. And the setup there.
I was going to ask about that, if they roped or if they used bolos.
No, they use hand braided riatas, all the stuff that the gauchos are making, you know, in their off time. But so first of all, they set me up with this like Mexican, touristy kind of saddle with a tree, more standard. Because the gauchos, honestly, they weren't very, happy about the fact that I was there.
Yeah.
Very, very nice people, but I think that in their mind, they thought that they're stuck with this gringo.
Sure.
That they're going to have to babysit for a couple months.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, we've already got all this work to do, and now we got to deal with this guy too.
Sure.
And I
can see where they're coming from, right? What you're describing, most people would be a liability.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, and just like any ranch out on the American West, you know, if you got some touristy guy or something that, you know, it's coming in, you don't know anything about, you're just going to assume the worst and think that this guy even really know how to ride a horse or whatever. And,
I mean, we get messages like weekly from people that want to come out here and intern on the Six Ranch. It's pretty cush living out here,
right?
You know, compared to what you're talking about, but it's still ranching, and it's not what people think from watching Yellowstone, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're not just riding off into the sunset to sit by a lake in the evening and, you know, drink whiskey out of a crystal glass that's there for some reason. Like, it's hard and it's long and it's not sexy.
Yeah.
Unless you're into that kind of thing, which you are, you know. So, yeah, that's just phenomenal. Did you get to do anything else while you were there?
Well, when I was on the ranch itself, it was pretty much... pretty much just gathering. And
do you like the horses?
Did that was one thing. The gauchos are so, they're such incredible horsemen.
Really?
They're, you know, they're born to do it. And, you know, they had kind of the cow boss, so to speak. He had a kid that was probably 4 years old, and he'd literally tie him to the horse. And they really, I mean, they're just born and bred. Mm-hmm. They live on horses. And there was probably a string of 60 or something. And every day the riding was so hard on those horses and the terrain and everything. So you're on a different one. They cycle them through, and, you know, you try not to get on the same horse even, you know, but once a week. Probably, and they literally need to heal, and it wasn't uncommon to have to get the horse back and stitch it up from something that had been impaled on a sharp stick or torn open on something or another. But yeah, their saddles, they're totally soft. Eventually, once they realized that I could ride and I was worth my salt, and I kind of integrated into their style. And it's basically just a sheepskin with a cinch on it and a steel ring that would rest right on that cinch, kind of behind your leg. And that's what the Riato is tied to.
Oh, so you're tied hard and fast.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a breast collar?
Yeah.
Okay.
But there was, it was kind of hard. It's almost like barebacking.
Yeah.
But the thing that was the most difficult is you got this 50-foot rope. Mm-hmm. And you've got no horn to dally off on.
Sure.
And so they just, you know, when you do rope something, it runs out to the end, and that's all you can do. You can't shorten it up at all. And so to get a cow moved through all this super thick brush and everything at the end of 50 feet, you could basically have one guy that's tied to it, and then one or two people that's got to haze it in the right direction, and you're getting wrapped around every single thing.
Yeah.
And so it was a very, very slow process, and one that wasn't super efficient.
Yeah. Were you missing a saddle with a Wade tree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think if I was to go down there and do it again, I'd probably bring my own. Yeah. It was definitely cool to kind of fully immerse and do it the way that they did it, just for the experience. But I know that we could have moved a lot more.
Did anybody carry a bolo for tripping cattle?
No. And I understand that that's like pretty popular and they use it in different areas, but that particular outfit, I didn't even see one of those.
I would love to see somebody who's good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. I don't know if it was open enough that it would have been good.
It sounds a little tight for it.
I think you hardly have room to swing one of those things over your head, you know, let alone get it to the cow's feet without snagging up on something.
Yeah. I talked to a guy, and I can't remember where he was from in Argentina, but he showed me a bunch of pictures, and everybody carried bolos down there, and they'd carry a few of them on their horse. And they'd usually carry a couple that were short and real thin for birds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they flushed birds out, they could knock a bird out of the sky and wrap them up with these little bolos. And, you know, they'd have bigger ones for tripping cattle and tripping horses, but they would have two from like the center point. They would have two relatively long strands that went to round rawhide patches that had stones or lead inside of them. And then one that was shorter that had kind of an oval shaped one. And, you know, how you held it in your hand and how you threw it. Like it was as much of an art to throwing those bolos as it is for us to throw a rope, or for those gauchos down there to throw a rope. But yeah, I bet that was pretty sporty. Did you get hurt at all? Did you come home healthy?
Yeah, no, on that trip, I was totally healthy.
Yeah.
I don't remember a single thing, you know, really happening on that trip.
I worry about you when you travel these days. I almost had to go to Vietnam to get you a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a altogether different scenario. that one.
We almost lost Bjorn.
Yeah. No, that was quite interesting. I've got an all new respect for infection in general. And then, you know, the limitations of medicine in developing countries.
Give me the 5-minute version of that.
Well, I had gone to Southeast Asia. I was in Malaysia at the time, and in fact, the plan was, well, I didn't have a plan, but I met somebody there. I don't travel with plans, really. I got a ticket and then book a place to stay the night that I show up and then kind of wing it from there. But I'd met somebody that was going to the Philippines on a dive trip, and she asked if I wanted to go, and that sounded pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But like the day before we were going to leave, there was a giant volcano that erupted and it basically shut down the entire country for a week because they couldn't fly in and out. And so I had to call an audible and I thought, well, what's close to here and where would I like to go? And Vietnam kind of stood out. So I hopped a plane up there and within a couple of days, I just was walking through this yard at a hostel and barefooted. It was in grass and I stepped on some little thorn or something and just punctured my foot and I didn't think anything of it. It's something that would happen almost daily here. I've always got, you know, some kind of open wound.
Yeah.
And I mean, it literally, I went, rinsed my foot off and put a Band-Aid over it. And I just kind of expected that to be the end of it. And I'd almost completely forgotten that that had happened at all. But a week later, I was on a motorcycle that I'd rented and was up in the very northern part of the country on the Chinese border, a multi-day trip on the Hajang Loop, which is probably the most amazing place that I could ever see, you know, riding a motorcycle in the whole world. It's beauty that's so breathtaking that it's almost hard to for your brain to fully even trust that your eyes are seeing it. Yeah. It's like almost computer generated, like something you'd see on like Lord of the Rings or something. It's like, this is too awesome to be real.
But that's how I feel in hells a lot. Like it's almost impossible to understand what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you think about it in terms of like, what if I had to walk through this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made me really respect the, you know, the warfare that happened there because I mean, these hills are so steep and the jungle is so thick. And it's like, if I had to get from where I am to the top of that hill, I don't know if it's physically possible to do, let alone if someone's up there shooting at you.
Right.
I can't even imagine. But anyway, I woke up and one morning and was just really, really sick and I couldn't walk. My foot was super swollen and I had met this Danish girl the night before and I remembered that she was a nurse. So I kind of like jumped down to the common area on one foot and I said, you're a nurse, right? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what do you think about this? And she, her mouth came open. She goes, oh my God, you need to get to a hospital. Like now.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Right. And I was like, well, you know, I was kind of thinking that this ride was going to last another like 3 or 4 days. And is there any way you think that I can just finish it up? She said, absolutely not. You have to go and get medical attention as quickly as you can. And honestly, I mean, she probably saved my life and that advice. And I don't know, you know, what would have happened if she hadn't been so adamant about that. But as it was, it's, you know, one of the most remote parts of that country. And then it also happened to be during a week-long festival called Tet, I believe. Mm. It's kind of a Chinese New Year. And so everything was shut down. And so, I mean, even something like a rudimentary pharmacy where I could have gotten like, even just some over-the-counter type
of something. Yeah.
Any sort of antibiotic. Those were all closed. Mm. I mean, these are tiny, tiny little villages where they're like traditional mountain villages. The inhabitants.
It's probably as likely that somebody's going to smash up a bunch of herbs in a mortar and pestle and be like, rub this in your eyeball.
Right.
Like finding a bunch of legit antibiotics.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And the people up there, you know, they don't even speak Vietnamese. They've got their own cultures and their own languages, and you know, it's super diverse. But yeah, you know, I could have probably found some medicine woman that would, you know, put some mud on it or something like that. But unfortunately, that wouldn't have probably helped. Ultimately, it took me about a day and a half, almost 2 days to get to the place that I rented the bike. And I immediately asked them, you know, where I could go to get some medical attention. And they said, what do you need? And I showed them my foot and they said, oh God, you can't treat that. If you go to the hospital here, you'll probably die. You need to go to Hanoi where they have like real medicine, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was another, I don't know, 12 or 14 hour bus ride. And then the soonest bus, wasn't leaving until the next day. And so, and by the time I got there, I was pretty much, completely, out of it. You know, I don't really have a good recollection of it. I think I was just kind of fading in and out of consciousness on the last leg of that journey. And when I finally arrived there, they had to wheel me in a wheelchair. I didn't have the strength to even be mobile on my own, and spent 5 days in the hospital there getting IV antibiotics and everything. And I knew it was a pretty touch and go situation. While I was in there, I could appreciate like how sick that I was, but it really wasn't until I got all the way home and my doctor was looking through the lab work and stuff. And that's when I realized how close I really was, because, he said, this like off the chart stuff. You're really lucky to be here.
So what did it turn out to be? Was it blood poisoning?
So it was an infection, and they didn't ever do a blood culture, which is, I guess, standard here. But he had just kind of thought it was either staph or strep infection. But, you know, like my foot was so swollen up that it was about to burst out of the skin. And I had the kind of the classic big red stripe that had run from my foot all the way up into my groin. And that was, I guess, an indication of some kind of blood poisoning. I was completely septic when I showed up, and pretty much organs and systems were shutting down.
Yeah.
So,
well, we were, you know, getting really spotty information back here, and everybody was, you know, obviously concerned. And then when pictures started rolling through, not only of your foot and of your leg, but also of like the treatment facility,
mm-hmm.
that's when me and Paul were like, man, do we need to go get him?
Yeah.
And, you know, we were definitely ready to do that, but you were also telling us, nah, you're fine.
Well, I was purposefully being pretty vague because, you know, there was definitely a few days when I wasn't sure if I was going to make it. But I also knew that there was nothing that anybody from back home would be able to do.
Put you in a box, right, and get you to a place where, you know, there's a little bit better medicine.
Yeah.
Was the plan anyways. Well, glad you made it through that. Did that change anything about how you travel? Is there, any action? Like, do you bring antibiotics with you now? Do you just like take foreign injuries more seriously? Like, did that change anything for you?
Yeah, absolutely. For one, I mean, it kind of just made me recognize that, you know, I'm not the invincible person that I thought maybe I was.
Yeah.
And that there are a lot of, you know, things out there in the world that, you know, our immune systems aren't, you know, used to, dealing with.
Yeah.
you know, someone from a foreign country can come over and drink our water that we consider clean and get sick.
Sure.
It's just a matter of, like, you know, what your body's been exposed to in the past. And, you know, if that would have happened here, my body would have taken care of it. But knowing that now, I travel with a whole myriad of different preventative kind of things. I've got a good relationship with my doctor because I've seen him for years. And, you know, knowing, you know, the places in the world that I go and that we have got a trust and rapport, he's prescribed a pretty stout kind of travel package with several different kinds of antibiotics, pain medication, things like that, that would, in an event like that, that I would be able to, you know, get a hold of him and he kind of walked me through like a treatment process to like get me to someplace.
Yeah. I usually bring a Z-Pack and Cipro, and a malaria prophylactic if it's in a malaria place. But yeah, I think that going and talking to a doctor, especially if you're going to be in an area where you're not going to have access to quick medicine, even there's plenty of places in Alaska that fall under that category.
Yeah, totally.
Like Cipro, if you've got bad GI stuff, that's probably as good as anything for getting you out of it. And same with a Z-Pack for different deals. But yeah, I do recommend that people go and talk to a travel doctor before they go on a trip like that if they're not going to have quick access.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interrupting once again to talk about some wildlife biology. Ask any fly fisher where their bucket list trout location is, and you're likely to hear them talk about Argentina. Argentina offers a wide variety of salmonid habitat, all of it perfect for the growth of very large trout. But what many people don't realize is that salmonids are not native to the region, or South America for that matter. Trout have been stocked throughout the Southern Hemisphere periodically over the last 175 years, up and down South America. Introduced species include rainbow trout, brown trout, brook trout, lake trout, Arctic char. Largely, trout and char species have been introduced to increase recreational angling opportunities, which can stimulate local and regional economies through tourism. These introductions have often occurred through government initiatives and solicited the help from foreign governments, the U.S. included, to aid in providing these fish. The large abundance and variety of fish food in these rivers and lakes have allowed for the successful naturalization of rainbow and brown trout throughout the region, where they have the opportunity to grow to these big sizes. Interestingly, the native fish populations in these rivers have been put at risk due to the predatory nature of the introduced trout. In certain areas, native fish are facing extirpation. Extirpation is, more or less, the localized extinction of species. This is highlighted in the very southern tip of Argentina in Tierra del Fuego. Here, brown trout, Salmo truta, I think is how you say it, have a stronghold. In certain areas, brown trout have completely taken over the home streams that were previously inhabited by native fish. If you're familiar with brown trout and their aggressive feeding behavior, you won't be surprised to hear that they have eaten themselves out of house and home in the Rio Grande system of Tierra del Fuego, and in turn have adapted to meet their dietary needs. Research conducted on this river by Sarah O'Neill and Jack Stanford from the University of Montana that was published in 2011 showed members of this brown trout population have decided to turn to anadromy to find their food as freshwater resources have become limited. Fish that are anadromous are born in freshwater, then move out to saltwater to grow, then return to freshwater to spawn. However, not all brown trout in this system will become anadromous. This is defined as partial migration, where some members of the population will be residents and live in freshwater their entire lives, while others may become anadromous. We see this commonly occur on the west coast of the U.S., where certain rainbow trout will remain resident, while others will become anadromous, and now wear the title of steelhead. O'Neill and Stanford proposed that the brown trout in the Rio Grande became anadromous due to the food availability hypothesis, which was first presented by Gross in 1988. This hypothesis claims that anadromy occurs in places where food in the marine environment exceeds those in the freshwater environment. In the freshwater of the Rio Grande, brown trout eat bugs. Other brown trout and native fish, when they're available, similar to the brown trout we see in any inland stream in the U.S. But the diet of the sea-run brown trout is far more exciting. According to a 2010 publication by Ciancio, large sea brown trout will eat a variety of food in the marine environment, but it mainly consists of sprat, a fish belonging to the herring family, squid, silversides, and amphipods, or zooplankton. This publication also found that brown trout, compared to steelhead with Argentina, selected more digestible prey with a higher energy density, meaning that brown trout required less food to grow faster. As a result, the brown trout that travel seaward for food grow disproportionately to their resident counterparts, just like steelhead and residualized rainbow trout. The fish are truly of legendary size and bring in anglers from across the globe hoping to handle one of these behemoths. In this Rio Grande system, O'Neill and Stanford estimated that the population of anadromous brown trout was over 55,000 in the early 2000s, and because of the estimation type, it was likely underestimated. In 2019, Trout Unlimited claimed that the population had grown even more, upward of 70,000 fish, and suggested that these might be the largest sea-run brown trout in the world. At the Boise Fire Department, you have to deal with all the normal stuff that structure firefighters have to deal with. You know, like, is it ab day? Is it... being that it's Boise, and given the style of recreation that you do when you're close to home, you end up doing a lot of swift water rescue stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's the middle of winter. We should probably be talking about avalanche safety right now, but it's also an El Nino year. And El Nino is currently predicted to hold at least until April. What I think that's going to mean is that for us in the Northwest, that we're going to continue to have warmer than normal conditions. I think we'll probably get hit by a storm at some point that has a lot of moisture in it, and it's going to come off fast. So instead of that avalanche coming down the mountain in the form of snow, I think it's going to come down the mountain in the form of extreme white water.
Yeah.
And I believe that this spring is going to have some really significant white water. So it's a good enough time as any to talk about swift water rescue. And I'd love to hear a story or two about some incidents that you've been involved in, and also some lessons learned and some advice for people to be safe out there, because there's a lot of people that end up on these rivers that don't have a ton of experience and maybe don't know just how dangerous the situation is and how fast it can get dangerous and, you know, what it can look like. I've been involved in plenty of these myself through guiding whitewater and then just being on the rivers all the time. But what's a story that comes to mind?
Well, from a work point of view, I'm a member of the swift water rescue team on the department. We've got about 300 people on our department. And I think that around 30 are trained in swift water. They're swift water rescue technicians and dive team members. So we do surface rescue and swift water, and then do subsurface rescue if, you know, somebody is drowned in a pond or a lake or something like that. But most of the stuff that we do is just on the Boise River. It's a really popular place to float. when, you know, temperatures get up 100 degrees, and there are literally thousands of people a day that go down, especially on weekends, that it's almost a continuous flow of people going down a couple mile stretch. And so the Boise River is really not that menacing, especially later on in the summer when temperatures, the water temperatures outside are, you know, kind of conducive to wanting to actually be in the water. In the spring, there's always people that are trying to get out there early when it's in flood stage and they get themselves into trouble. But I would say 90% of the issues we have are revolving around strainers. And
which is what?
More or less anything in the water that's going to impede your ability to maintain, like, floating down the river. Most of the time that looks like a log jam or even a single log, a tree, something that's fallen into the river. And that, as you're floating down, is going to snag you, grab you, somehow hold on to you or prevent you from going further down. And when the water's moving, you know, a lot of it, you know, all the water's going down under the log jam because that's just the way that the water is flowing.
Right.
And so if you, you know, bump into that, then it's going to want to pull you under and pull you under that, under those logs. And there's stobs and things that are sticking out of the logs that hang up and basically pin you underwater. And the other part of that is these people that are recreationally floating down on inner tubes and small rafts.
Inflatable unicorns from Walmart.
That too. A lot of those, actually. Mm-hmm. You know. So, yeah, first of all, make sure that your watercraft, so to speak, is something that's designed to go down the river and not to be used in a swimming pool.
Right.
I think a lot of people, they, you know, they think this is the lazy river at the water park, and they treat it with that same amount of respect. And as soon as you lose respect for the river is when it gets dangerous. And they've got these, you know, I don't know what it is, why people want to do this. They tie together these giant flotillas with, you know, 30 people, and everybody's got a cooler on a different inner tube, and then they tie that to themselves, and they tie themselves all together. Like, probably one of the most dangerous things that you can have in moving water is a rope. And the swift water and ropes are just a deadly combination.
Mm-hmm.
You get all these things tied together and you lose your ability to, you know, for one, like, navigate the river. You know, they just think that they're going to bump down the sides as if it was like a concrete wall. But, you know, there's hazards. There's things that can snag you, low limbs that'll drag you off. And then if you find yourself in the water with all these ropes and strings and things, that it's just to, you know, you're inevitably going to wrap up in it, get held underwater and drown.
You're creating a net.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so a story that comes to mind is that one of these giant things were coming down, and you've got 20 people and they're trying to paddle in different directions, and the level of awareness and consumption of alcohol, you know, they're just not real aware, and they almost always, like, wrap up on logs. And in this case, it was just a bridge pier. And you know, a guy had fallen off, and the whole flotilla had gone around both sides of the pier, and he had got basically rope wrapped around his neck and was being held where just his you know, barely his lips were above the water. And we just happened to be on those big days, you know, when we know there's going to be 1,000 people on the the water. It's like we just, you know, basically have breakfast and get our jet boat and jet ski on the water, knowing that these calls are just going to start rolling in.
It's just going to happen.
And luckily for this guy, we just happened to be right there when it happened, because if, you know, we were, you know, half mile upstream, I don't know if we'd have gotten there in time. Basically, just rip up next to him and jump out and be able to cut him free. But yeah, to be safe, don't tie yourself to anything. Make sure you have a life jacket that's that fits well. It's not going to slip over your head.
Got to have it tight.
Yeah. And even, you know, this isn't like a, you know, class 3 or 4 or 5 river, you know. It's very kind of gentle, but you know, bad things can happen in fairly slow moving water also, especially if you're, you know, wrapped around a line or something.
And don't underestimate the force of water that's moving at any speed.
Yeah.
So think about how heavy a gallon of milk is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then multiply that by thousands and get it moving. You know, if I hit you with a gallon of milk right now that was moving 3 miles an hour, might knock the wind out of you.
Mm-hmm.
If I hit you with 1,000 of those going 3 miles an hour, it'd blow you through the wall.
Yeah.
Like you just can't physically stand up to that kind of pressure. So I think people see slow moving water and they think no big deal. Another thing that drives me crazy, and I used to constantly have these conversations, and I kind of still do with people, I guess. I'd say, hey, here's a life jacket. You know, if you're on my boat, it's like say we're taking the jet boat out or something. Mm-hmm. We're going to run up hills. I say, look, here's your life jacket. Here's where the spare life jackets are. Here's the fire extinguisher. Here's the first aid kit. Here's instructions for how to use everything in the first aid kit. Here's how the boat works in case I can't run the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you're not required to wear a life jacket, but I wear mine. And usually that's the end of it. Sometimes people say, well, I'm a really good swimmer. Mm-hmm. I don't need a life jacket. Like, well, that's fantastic. I'm a pretty good swimmer too, but I can't swim at all if I'm unconscious.
Exactly.
Yeah. And sometimes people get it at that point, but oftentimes they do not. If you're in a raft, man, if you're in a raft that has a frame and that raft goes over, there are so many hard points on that boat that almost everybody's going to get hit. You know, the water's soft and the rubber's soft, but there's a lot of hard things.
Yeah.
And 16 foot long oar coming over the top as a raft flips, like, you're about to get hit by like a Barry Bonds steroid baseball bat, you know, and you get swatted down into the water and you're unconscious. Like, man, you need a life jacket that's going to like really take care of you, get you back up to the surface and get you back up to the surface so that your face is in the air.
Right.
And another thing to look at, and this was a big deal to me when I was guiding whitewater a lot from rafts, is learning, how many pounds of buoyancy your life jacket provides.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be able to read that on there. I preferred buoyancy of 20 pounds or more. A lot of these life jackets, the Swiftwater jackets, are really light on their buoyancy. And, you know, the Swiftwater life jackets, as you know, do a completely different job. But in the heavy turbulence that we get in some of these suckholes and in hells and in the salmon, you can still have that great big life jacket on and be underwater for a meaningful amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if, you know, everyone's, you know, pretty much anybody can hold their breath for 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's in a stagnant, you know, in a swimming pool or something like that. That's assuming that you had a full breath when you went under, and sometimes it happens, a raft will flip so quick that you don't have the time to take that breath.
You get a gulp.
You've got adrenaline.
Yeah.
You're maybe working hard.
Probably sucked in some water too. That's causing some panic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, sometimes, being underwater for 10 seconds, it seems like an absolute eternity.
Yeah. If you weren't planning on it, 10 seconds is a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I came out of the boat like 3 times on the whichever fork of the pad I was on this summer. And I was fine with it. I've swam a lot of rapids. I'm relatively comfortable with that. But what scared me on that deal is that's a pretty shallow river that's moving really fast. And I was feeling the bottom sometimes. Mm-hmm. And man, if it gets a hold of your foot in the wrong kind of crack, you're just going to get pinned down by that water and there's nothing anybody's going to be able to do in time.
Yep. Foot entrapments are a major thing and they kill a lot of people.
Yeah.
Your kind of instinct, if you're floating down and you can touch the bottom, is to try to stand up.
Yeah.
It's really the absolute worst thing that you can do.
Yeah.
If the water is over your knee and it's moving, you don't want to stand up in it.
Yeah.
Because even hip height water, if your foot slides in between a couple of rocks, the force of the water can lay you over and, you'll lay down at the bottom and drown in, 2.5 feet of water.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the knee height level is a good one. If you're going down the river, having an out of boat experience and your feet are up downstream and you can feel your butt kind of dragging along the bottom and it's slow, mm-hmm. that's probably the time that you can give it a try, but you still need to be really cautious about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, a better option would be maybe just flip over on your stomach and just swim all the way to the bank or swim back to the boat or whatever.
I'm a big fan of swim back to the boat.
Yeah.
And so many guides still say, no, we want you to, get in that recliner position and stuff. But realistically, every guide that gets out of the boat is swimming back to the boat. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guides now are saying, hey, swim back to the boat. But the little safety brief that they have at the beginning still teaches that old school recliner position. It kind of drives me crazy. I want people to hold onto their paddle and actively swim.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. I paddle with a group of guys that, we do some pretty, big whitewater stuff. As far as we know, we're the only ones, that have done a 5-person paddle raft team from, the top to the bottom of the North Fork of the Payette River. Which is a pretty big accomplishment, but the captain who has, been on that river since he was a kid, his big safety briefing is, forget everything you've learned about that whitewater safety position. It's like, if you fall out of this boat in this water, you need to swim like your life depends on it back to the boat as fast as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Because in, the few times that somebody's fallen out in that water, by the time their head even pops up, they might 20 feet away and being swept quickly. And that type of water will either drown you or half the people that die on the Payette, it's from trauma, or just being battered to death on the rocks because it's moving that fast. And you want to take an active role in saving yourself.
Yeah.
And that isn't just sitting there and waiting for somebody to throw you a rope.
Yep.
You have to swim.
Yeah. And if you're out of the boat too, you've really distracted everybody else that's in the boat and they're no longer maneuvering that boat the way it needs to. At least half the focus in the boat is probably on you. So people aren't paddling correctly anymore. Mm-hmm. And you've now added to the problem by being in there. So you can't just wait until it pools out at the bottom. You need to get over there and get a hold of that line so somebody can drag you back in. Mm-hmm. And then everybody can focus on the task at hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I was on the Grand Ronde several years ago. I was guiding a trip then. It wasn't a personal trip. And we'd left camp in the morning, probably 10 o'clock in the morning, and didn't make it very far, and found a family that had gotten stuck on a rock in the middle of the river and couldn't get off. Mm-hmm. They'd been there all night.
Oh, wow.
They'd been there all night. And it was relatively fast on both sides of them. Yeah. And I said, "You guys need some help? You good?" And the husband goes, "We're good." And the wife said, "We're not.
No, we are not."
So I can't imagine the conversations they'd been having that night, but they had kids with them and stuff. It was they'd tried a few things, but mostly they were just stuck. And I pulled over down below. I think there's two or three other guides with me, and we went back up, strung together some lines, and we were going to Z-drag them off if we couldn't pull them off. And I swam out there and got a hold of them and got tied up to them. But even just swimming out there, holding on to a rope, feels like, man, I'm doing the wrong thing right now.
Yeah.
But there's nothing else to be done besides leave them there, which is unacceptable. I think,
totally.
You know, it's definitely a code in any maritime emergency. If somebody needs help, you help them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like
that's just what it is. Your agenda doesn't matter anymore. Doesn't matter if you're at work, like you stop and you help.
Yeah.
And we were able to, just with the guides, to pull them off without even hooking up a Z-drag system. And they were pretty happy. But that same deal, these folks had gone there. They'd rented a raft. They'd floated this river that they thought was no big deal. And it is. It's a class 3- river, mm-hmm. most of the time. But there are so many ways to die. And, you know, they didn't know how to swim through the rapids that were on either side of them. And it had to have been just a terrifying night. wondering, like, who's going to come along and help us? How are we going to get out of this? Yeah.
Isn't that such a guy thing to do? I mean, you're out there marooned on a rock in the middle of a whitewater scenario all night long, and the first bit of help that shows up, and the guy goes, "Oh, we're good."
Just taking a breather.
It's like, if you were good, you'd have got yourself out of this situation about 8 or 10 hours ago.
Yeah. So, I don't know, man. I'm glad that people still have that sense of adventure and want to get out there and do those things. I do think that it's a good idea to find ways to qualify yourself for that adventure beforehand so that you don't put people at risk, put yourself at risk, that's unnecessary. You know, risk is part of what makes it all sweet. And, you know, I'll be the first to acknowledge that. But if you're going to put somebody else at more risk to save you, then that's not okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, keeping yourself safe is the number one priority. Keeping the people safe in your party is your next responsibility. And then, yeah, making sure that you're not presenting, you know, going to potentially cause an issue that other people are going to have to be at risk to save you. It's all about, like, kind of knowing your limitations and being educated and being prepared, you know, making sure that you do have ropes and lines and things that you can set up, a rope system, having, you know, pulleys and having prussics and things that you can use to get yourself out of a bad situation, because you kind of, like, as in, well, with any kind of outdoor activity, whether it's camping or hunting or horse packing or anything, it's kind of like you need to make sure that you're prepared for the absolute worst thing to happen and have the knowledge and the equipment to deal with it.
Yeah. Do you feel like the Boise Fire Department has sufficient support from people?
Yeah, generally.
Is there something people can do to support you better? And there's a large number of people from Boise that follow this show. Like, is there anything you guys need? Is there ways that they can help you? Like more mirrors for your gym? some kind of tanning solution?
No, buy our calendars, you know, when they come out. the only thing that I can think of that I've experienced in the 10 years that I've been on the department that, you know, we really needed the support was when we were trying to pass a bond to get some real needed equipment. And it was something to the tune of a couple $1 million or something like that. And our community really did step up and ultimately voted. And I think it was, you know, you needed something like 3/4 of the people. So it, and it passed and we got it. And so I think we are really well supported. Our community appreciates us. And, you know, for that, we're super grateful. You know, I don't know why anybody would ever want to be a police officer, you know, because they, unfortunately, they just don't get that kind of support from the community. So well, we see the differences and we really appreciate the fact that, you know, people really, they're willing to go to bat for us. And I think other than that, maybe just, you know, when it comes time to vote for, you know, you know, kind of our city government and things like that, and really take into consideration the candidate that we're backing, because we do our research and we really, you know, when we support a certain candidate, it's for a good reason. And so I think that's the only thing that I can think of, like, as far as support. You know, we are funded by the taxpayers and things like that. So, like, individual contributions and things like that is not really a thing. It's not like, you know, in a community like this where the volunteer department is kind of run off of the, you know, in large part funded by people's generosity,
right,
and showing up to the barbecue and making, you know, making contributions or things like that. Like, we're funded by the taxpayers, and like the amount of money that we actually get is more of a function of, you know, how the city chooses to allocate those funds. And that's why it's so important that we have people like in the mayor's position, for instance, that are advocates of the fire department, and they are willing to give us the funding that we need, because it all comes out of one big pot, and it just kind of depending on who is in charge of allocating those funds is like how much of that we get. And it really does make a difference.
Yeah. Okay. So pay your taxes, pay attention, and don't tie yourself to anything else if you're in water that's moving.
Yeah. Make sure you have a knife.
Yeah. That's a good one. Always.
If you have any kind of rope or anything, the ability to cut yourself free from it is absolutely going to save your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Having a good knife is extremely important. Yeah. All the time. That's the thing that I hate the most about flying. Honestly, like, growing up, I think it was like 4 inches, right? You could have a knife as long as it didn't have a blade longer than 4 inches,
right,
if you're on a plane.
Yeah.
And, you know, that didn't cause problems until 9/11. But yeah, I absolutely hate showing up at a place when I've just flown and, you know, before I've been able to get into my luggage, inevitably I'll need a knife or something that's mm-hmm. not an emergency, but God forbid that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been just a huge number of circumstances in my life where a knife made the difference between living and dying.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to carry one with them and know how to use it and have the right knife for the job.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
there are a bunch of different knives out there and they're all very specialized. And
yeah,
yeah, it's funny. I've had people straight up like walk up to me, like at a bar or something and say like, why are you carrying that knife? Are you like afraid? Is somebody going to attack you? And, you know, yeah. thought that I had it on me for like kind of some like as a personal protection or something like that. And it's like, I use my knife friggin' 25 times a day.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine. And so the one time that you forget it, you realize how much it's like wearing a watch. You don't realize how many times you look at it until you don't wear it. And, and you're constantly looking down at your naked wrist.
Yeah. Mine's charging right now and I feel like I'm completely naked.
But, yeah, it's like, I don't understand how, you know, people can even, you know, make it through a day without like the fact that not every single person out there is carrying a knife. It's kind of boggling me. That was so, you know, beat into me as a kid. I would get scolded.
Yeah.
You know, where's your knife?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, and if like, especially if a lady asks you for your knife and you don't have one on you.
Yeah.
Like, oof, that's like man card revoked immediately. Yep.
Yeah.
It's horrifying. I got we're going to wrap up here in just a second, but I'll show you this, this knife that, that Thomas Rucker, made for me this spring. It is just beautiful, beautiful. I've got it sitting out here on my bench, but yeah, there's all kinds of good knives out there. Is there a knife that you carry on the daily that you love and just want to have? Is there a brand that we should talk about for people to be aware of?
Well, I was about a year ago, I was gifted, the best knife that I've ever had. It was a Benchmade Shootout, like a stiletto style, that auto, you know, opens out the front and, retracts.
Yeah.
And, unfortunately, I somehow lost that. Oh, and it's like a...
Was it the Infidel?
No, I think it's called Shootout.
Called a Shootout?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was so light that it almost felt like it was a toy or something. But it was incredibly, you know, strong. And I want to get another one, but I'm just not willing to drop the $350 or whatever the
heck it costs. Is that
what they are? Yeah.
Yeah.
But absolutely, I'm going to get another one. It's it's like sunglasses, you know, you get a nice pair and they're just going to get lost, immediately. And you get you get something from the gas station and you can't freaking lose the things. You can stand at the top of a cliff, toss them off. And by the time you even get to the parking lot, somebody's going to run up and say, "Hey, are these yours?" It's like a cheap knife. I mean, a cheap knife being like a $50 knife or something like that, you know, I can carry around for 10 or 15 years. And, in this case, you know, I get something good and inevitably the clip got hung up on something walking through the brush or pulled out of my pocket or something like that.
Those pocket clips. I mean, they're convenient for being able to get to your knife quickly, but they also cause a lot of knives to get lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like pulling them off anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather just have to fish for deeper down into my pocket to get at a knife and have it actually be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if when I do get that knife again, it's my dad refuses to wear those clips and you know, sure, it's not as convenient to dig through your pocket, but you always know it's gonna be there.
Yeah. I love wearing them around my neck. You know, I wear those Argali knives around my neck 90% of the time. And, you know, I put it on before I put on my t-shirt in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's the last thing I take off before I go to bed. And it's like a watch. It's just part of what I wear. And I found that to be a really convenient way to carry a knife, and it's out of the way. And, it's also easy for me to get to. I think having stuff central to your body, you know, in the middle of your chest, whether that's your bino harness or a handgun or whatever, I think that's a good place to carry it because you can get to it with either hand. It's where your hands naturally go in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good place to carry. But yeah, those little clips, I'm not a fan of. What color was your Shootout?
It was just black.
Just black.
Black, and then the blade was kind of this carbon type of flat black. Yeah, the whole thing.
All right. Well, if anybody at Benchmade's listening, Bjorn needs a new knife. He promises not to lose this one.
Yeah.
Let me know, and we'll get it shipped over to him. All right, man. Well, this one's been a long time coming, and I'm appreciative of your stories, and I love your sense of adventure. I love your sense of service, and hopefully somebody learns something from this. It'll help stoke their sense of adventure and keep them safe while they're doing it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come and chat with you.
Yeah.
You know, seeing friends and family members, you know, kind of cycle through here over the years. And it's just, I'm honored to be a part of it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you.
Yep.
Bye, everybody. Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and, you know, we're just getting started.